Well, welcome back to the Focus on Agriculture podcast. I'm your host, Preston.
And I'm Jason.
So, Jason, today we're here in Central Illinois at the beautiful Illinois Soybean Association headquarters.
Yeah.
So we appreciate, shout out to them for letting us host this podcast here.
Yeah, and they have some great events here throughout the year. And so farmers that are in the area, be sure to register for some of those events. They have some great speakers and get in here and learn and have a good meal to go along with it a lot of times.
Yeah, you know, today's podcast interview is actually kind of fitting that we're here at the Illinois Soybean Association a little bit, based off of today's guest. If you want to kind of give the audience a quick bio.
Yeah, Preston, we had a returning guest today, Dwayne Simpson, who we spoke with back in episode 82, who then was the head of North America Public Affairs, Science and Sustainability for Bayer Crop Science. He mentioned that he has a new role, which he'll describe when we get into the conversation.
Yeah, Jason, I think this conversation was definitely timely. You know, we always talk about farmers and the accessibility of crop protection products and how important they are for modern production ag in the U.S. and abroad. So without further ado, let's jump right into the conversation. Welcome back to the podcast, Dwayne. Just for the listeners, before we kick things off here, we have had you as a guest previously on the Focus on Agriculture podcast. For those listening and who want a deep dive into your history, they can refer to episode 82, quite a few episodes ago. So I'm curious, Dwayne, what are you up to today? What's changed in your world?
Well, thanks, Preston. Actually, just as part of Bayer's reorganization, I've just been announced as the new head of Ag Affairs and are licensed to operate for North America, Australia, New Zealand. That is a team that is responsible for our relationships with all of the ag value chain, our grower customer groups, along with the organizations that represent them, the trade associations we work with, along with leading a broad cross-functional team that aligns all of our licensed and operate efforts across the policy, regulatory, legal, communication space to those big issues that cross a lot of different functions to try to bring them together and make sure that we get our priorities set, get the right people involved, and drive towards a good strategy moving forward.
I can't even comprehend what all you have to keep straight there. You must have a pretty good sized team.
It's a small but mighty team. I'm blessed to work with a bunch of really good people, and of course a lot of other teams across the company that specialize in their own space, like from government affairs to legal to regulatory, that are much bigger teams that obviously have their own expertise.
Well, that's a really, I know you have a really interesting perspective, and like Preston mentioned, we talked before, and now we delved into quite a few different things, but there's been some changes. I mean, as always, things change in the ag world, and over the last year and a half since we spoke, there have been quite a few. And we thought one thing that interesting to cover that we'd like to talk about today is the herbicide registration process. So that's there's a company perspective, and then there's an EPA and a regulatory body perspective. And so we thought it would be interesting just to give our listeners a peek behind the curtain. Can you talk a little bit about that process, specifically from the regulatory body perspective, how that looks?
Sure. So if you think about every product that we use in the United States has to be registered for use by the Environmental Protection Agency and then registered in each of the states where it's going to be used. That process starts at EPA under FIFRA, that's the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act. And that registration process generally takes a couple of years for a new product, or product updates could be shorter. There's different timelines for each of those products. And the agency looks at everything with the product from human health safety, animal safety, the impact on the environment, how effective is the product? What is the what is the balance of the risk that exists with the product being used versus the benefit to the, in this case, the agriculture community? It's a very lengthy scientific process that takes a significant amount of work on the front end from the regulated entity, in this case Bayer, and our and then of course a significant amount of work by scientists at EPA that have to work through the process. EPA has been seeing its budgeting going down significantly over the last several years. We had a couple of times in the last decade where we've had a little bit of a spike, but again, their budget was cut again this year. And so they've got significant backlogs. And so the timelines on those registration processes continue to get extended as EPA is trying to handle more registrations that are coming in with fewer staff available to do it. They're barely able to keep up with turnover, let alone add staff at this moment. So it's a very long process, but it starts with the registrant saying, you know, I've got this new product, or I've got this product I want to re-register, or I've got a new use, and submitting it. The EPA takes a few weeks to look at the submission to make sure everything is in order. Sometimes there's a public comment period at that point. From there, you start going through the process of all of the different checks to make sure that you meet the different safety criteria. And then generally you end up in a negotiation with the agency about what the appropriate restrictions that need to be put on that label in order for the product to meet the need that it's intended to meet while meeting all the safety requirements that the government and frankly society expects EPA to watch out for when they're approving a product for use.
So Duane, you mentioned the public comment period, and I know recently the Xtendimax label was vacated by a court over a procedural piece related to the public comment period. Can you talk a little bit about that and a little bit more what that is and what that means?
Sure. So, Xtendimax's label had been in place, the label from 2018 was vacated in the courts going in 2020. And so it was 2016, I think, and then 2018 it was updated. In 2020, it was vacated. At that point, EPA issued a new label in the fall of 2020. I think it was late October 2020. And when they did that, they did not take public comment, and because they didn't see the use as a new use. Tavium was still on the market for over-the-top use in soybeans and cotton. And so EPA didn't believe that was a new use necessitating a public comment period. What the court said was that because Tavium's use was tied to the Xtendimax and Ingenia label that were vacated, that you couldn't refer to that as the public comment because the underlying risk assessment had been vacated in the 2020 case. And as a result, that meant that the agency should have taken public comment. Since they didn't take public comment, the action that they had taken to approve the product was void, and therefore the product is ordered off the market. The EPA issued an existing stocks order to allow for use this season. They don't want to disrupt the growing season. That order was relatively broad order that allows anything in the distribution channel basically to be distributed, sold, marketed, and used up through the existing cutoff dates. The distribution has a 30-day cutoff ahead of the cutoff date so that you're not distributing product ahead of time, which actually may help us move product from the northern regions where we have earlier cutoff dates to the south as we need it. As you move forward, manufacturers were prohibited from continuing to sell product that we had not already put into the distribution channel at that time. But that's basically what the agency did. So for anything that's going to happen in 2025 would take a new agency action, with a new registration submission and a new agency action. And obviously a public comment period would have to go along with that.
So do we foresee that new submission and the new process going forward?
So both Bayer and BASF have submitted labels. They're not identical, at least not at the moment, to the agency. We anticipate probably in the next couple of days that the early May that we should see the agency do what's called opening up the docket, for the dicamba label. They'll publish what's in those labels when they do that, and they'll be open for, you know, people can comment on that docket. And so that starts the process. And then we have to work through the work with the Environmental Fates Division of EPA around how do you, you know, make sure that the product, that as you're putting the restrictions in place, that, that the product is not having any unintended effects on the environment, and then work through that, and then potentially endangered species impacts, which could result in consultation with Fish and Wildlife and Marine Services. You know, and what, depending on how this process works, it gets very technical very quick, but depending on how this process works, you could have a label on the front end of that while you're awaiting consultation, or you may have to wait until after consultation, depending on, you know, how EPA determines the safe use of the product based on what's on the label. But, you know, our hope, certainly no guarantees here, but our hope is to have, you know, this process done in the sometime this fall for a 2025 label, so that we have a product available for growers in 2025 in soy and cotton that is, you know, agronomically relevant. That process is one that, you know, is not an easy outcome to ask the agency to do, just based on timelines. And so, you know, when the public comment period opens, that's an opportunity for those growers out there, your listeners, that may want to weigh in, that'll be an opportunity for them to weigh in to say, look, this is a product, a tool in the toolbox that we think we need in order to have a successful season for 25. And certainly once that happens, we'd be happy to share the link with the listeners, and if you want to put in the show notes, what have you, so that they can directly weigh in as appropriate.
So Dwayne, you mentioned successful season 2025. A lot of our listeners are consumers, students. Could you maybe take it a step back and just describe it at a very high level? Why is it important that farmers maintain access to technologies like these crop protection products?
Yeah. So let me go back in time just a little bit. And I try not to make it too much of a trip down memory lane, but, you know, for a little over a decade, we had Roundup Ready crops that were really, had solved for farmers the problem of how do you grow your crops without losing soil, sunlight, water, nutrients, those types of things to competing weeds. And Roundup you were able to spray Roundup over the top of your growing crop, that would kill off those competing weeds, and you would be able to produce a crop on that field with, you know, the most bountiful crop you can get on that field. And we wouldn't have to have as many other acres in production. We could produce as much as possible on those acres and not lose, you know, cotton or soybeans or corn to wheat, which is what happens when they out compete. You have to put more nitrogen on the field. You have to put more phosphorus on the field. You have to put more water on the field. All of those things are not as sustainable. So Roundup really made that work, but nature is capable of evolving, and some weeds that are very hard to control evolved to where in some places you had resistance to Roundup, and we had to find alternative chemistries that you can also spray to have that same type of effect. And with cotton and soybeans, we were able to adapt a product that we use in corn today and use with grasses today, and that's dicamba. And, you know, dicamba, to be able to have those crops be sprayed with those and kill off those weeds that Roundup was no longer able to control, that protects those farmers' yields and their investments and allows them to have the most productive crop possible on that land with the least amount of water, least amount of nutrients, et cetera, so that you can sustainably grow the crops we need to grow to feed and fuel and clothe the world. So that's the big picture. The why this product versus another product, it's a matter of, you know, it just takes decades, longer than a decade to to bring a chemistry and a seed technology together. And, you know, for it's not that we don't have herbicide tolerant generation four in the market, you know, in the process. We do. We have the next generation coming, and we actually have the fifth generation coming that broadens that toolbox so that farmers can reduce the opportunities for resistance. But we, in order to get there, they're a couple years away, then it's a decade away, then it's, you know, 15 years away. And so having today's tools available and being able to not rely on a single chemistry, so like we did with Roundup as an ag community, but to be able to have multiple chemistries that can extend the life of each of those tools is really important. And so that allows farmers to manage their crops sustainably in a way that they can protect their crops and rotate through the chemistries that they use, so you don't end up with big weed resistance problems that we had seen, you know, about a decade ago.
And so we've spent quite a bit of time talking here about dicamba. You mentioned Roundup. There's other chemistries, as you alluded to, that are out there in the market that we're using, and some of those are also facing challenges too, right? It's not just certain groups want to maybe take away dicamba or some other product. It's really, there's groups out there that would want to eliminate all herbicide use if they could, right? Would be the end goal.
Yeah, Jason, that's right. I mean, we've seen challenges to atrazine, which is, you know, it's not a product that Bayer invented. It's a generic today, but Syngenta is the primary registrant there, used primarily in corn. You know, we've seen a significant amount of activity around atrazine. We've seen 2,4-D, which, you know, was originally a Dow product, is a Corteva product. That chemistry is currently facing litigation from the same groups that sued the EPA over dicamba. You know, you've seen this in the insecticide world with products like chlorpyrifos. You know, the list goes on and on and on. You know, there's not really a registration anymore at the agency that doesn't get challenged in court. You have to realize that the way the rules are set up, you can fundraise to challenge to get pesticides off the market. There are people in society that want to see a pesticide-free agriculture, and they're more than happy to support organizations that do that. There are large foundations that support it. And then if you win, even on a technicality with the EPA, then you can go to the EPA and they have to reimburse you for those same litigation costs that you already raised money for. And so now the agency itself is funding or paying for that litigation. And when you do that, that's coming out of that budget that I mentioned at the top that keeps getting smaller and smaller. So now the agency has even fewer scientists to take the time to review, you know, these products. And of course, if a court sends a product back to the agency, that's work that the agency hadn't planned on, that hadn't budgeted for. And so now they have even more work on their plate. And so it really does put the agency in a tough place, because every case is litigated virtually. And so then if you're the agency, now you are not just regulating for what's in the statute, what is the, you know, what is the safe profile, the safe use, and the risk benefit. Now you're regulating from a perspective of how do I avoid litigation? What is the best way I can? And so it moves to an even more conservative decision-making process at the agency. And, you know, that's not always a bad thing to be conservative, but what you don't want to do is you don't want to get the risk benefit balance too far out of balance to where the products, new products that come on the market have so many restrictions on their use that they're not cost effective. And so you're using, as a farmer, you now are stuck with the choice of using older products that maybe have a more, a less beneficial environmental profile, because they haven't been under as strict a rule as the new agency rules. And they have, you know, a lower cost to them. And so you can use them more freely with less cost versus the newer products that are, you know, a more sustainable product, but now have rules that are so strict that to make it work on a farm within their budget, it gets difficult. So, you know, the long story short, the yes, there are activists that will sue on virtually all of the products. The agency responds to that, but you know, one of the risks of when the agency does it is that it makes it to where new products that are more environmentally palatable, that frankly, you know, consumers would prefer you use, become harder to make or make sense for a farmer in his budget.
There's a lot of frustrations and all that that you mentioned.
Process in a land far away. So Jason and I are sitting here in Central Illinois. I mean, what advice do you have for farmers on, you know, farmers who want to be advocates for if there's a way to help this process, or what do you recommend just a farmer in Central Illinois or wherever they're at? How can they help contribute or at least make their voices heard?
I mean, there's lots and lots of opportunities here, Preston, and I appreciate the question, because first of all, get involved in your local farmer organization. So if you're in Illinois, it's the Farm Bureau, the Illinois Corn Growers, the Illinois Soybean Association. I mean, those groups work every day to make sure farmers' voices are heard, and their national counterparts, the American Farm Bureau Federation, the National Corn Growers Association, American Soybean Association, that's step one. You know, get involved, help there, become active. The second piece is when those groups host EPA, be willing to bring them to your farm. I mean, the number one thing you can do is be transparent. When people see how you're actually farming, it blows their minds that, you know, how little amount of active ingredients actually being used in your farm, and how careful farmers are about what they use and where they use it, how they make their decisions, because, you know, and how tight the margins are. Let those regulators see it, because, you know, President Eisenhower used to say that farming looks mighty easy when you're, you know, 1,000 miles from the farm when your plow is a pencil. And that's true. And EPA has done a good job of trying to get out to the farm to see those things. And then the third point I would say is that when a company has a product that does go through a public comment period, or when the agency is considering things like the Endangered Species Act and how to do a new ESA compliance plan around herbicides or insecticides, if you get an opportunity to comment, send in a comment. And it's super short. It doesn't have to be complicated. You can send in a comment as simple as saying, you know, I'm Preston Schrader. I farm in Southern Illinois. I grow corn and soybeans on 1,500 acres. And, you know, I have problems with water hemp, and I need better control on glyphosate resistant water hemp and soybeans, you know, and I need it in the 2025 season. I've had great success with these products. I encourage you to approve them. Something like that, very simple. It doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to get into the technical details, but the EPA needs to hear from people who say this product works on my farm and I need it. And that helps them, because they're required under the law to balance the risks of the product with the benefits. And so they have to hear what the benefits are and what the challenges are that farmers are trying to overcome.
So how do they do that, Duane? How do they, just the very most basic, do they go to the EPA website? Where do you find, you know, where do you put your comments? You send a letter to your senator, you know, where do you do this?
Well, at the most basic level, when there's a public comment period, there will be a link. So EPA has what's called a docket, and that's where every document on that product will be there. And there's, generally speaking, like when we do dicamba, we'll send a link to people that are interested. We'll make it very easy for people to comment. You know, Corteva does the same thing with when they had Enlist. You'll see the same thing with other companies. You'll see the Triazine network put together an effort around making public comments on atrazine. So we try to make it as easy as possible. So that's the first piece. The second piece is, you did bring up something I didn't mention, and that is weighing in with your state representative, your state senator, your state ag commissioner, or ag secretary or director, depending what state you're in. And then your members of Congress are also as important. And that's as easy as an email. or a phone call. And what happens is when they hear from a number of their farmer constituents, they start asking questions and they'll call the EPA and ask, you know, it's generally the ag advisor over there, what's going on? Help me out here. And what can we do to help? And that helps. That's an important dialogue for the agency. You know, as the agency ultimately, it has oversight from Congress, and Congress provides their funding, and it also, you know, does perform oversight to make sure they're doing their job. So hearing from the member of Congress is really, really important when they're going through the entire process. So if you don't have a relationship with your local elected officials, I encourage people to do that. There's not really very many candidates for office in rural America who wouldn't love an opportunity to stand on a farm in front of a piece of green or red equipment and have their picture taken as they do an eggs and issues type of coffee or something in front of constituents. So, you know, there are plenty of opportunities, especially in an election year, to get to know your elected officials. And I always encourage people to do that, because that is an opportunity to build a relationship so that when questions come up about the safe use of different types of products, that those elected officials have someone they can call. And, you know, they look, members of Congress have to cover issues from pesticide use and safety to how the military is used and funded, to healthcare funding, to taxation, to energy use. I mean, you name it, every single part of the economy. Nobody in Congress is an expert on everything. And so they rely on people that they trust, and frankly, people from their district that they can trust on an issue like agriculture, is a great way to help them do their job better. And it's an opportunity for your listeners, if they want to weigh in, to do so.
When you reference an election year, and we're sitting here the last day of April in 2024, the country seems politically to be pretty well split down the middle, razor thin margins, it seems like, in both houses of Congress. And, you know, it seems like it's anybody's guess what the 2024 election will bring. You're pretty connected to politics. And, you know, what are your thoughts? Do you have any prediction on how this fall is going to turn out?
Well, I'll start with, anybody who tells you they know how this election is going to turn out is lying to you, because it is so incredibly close. You know, I think the conventional wisdom in Washington is that the Senate will probably change hands. And that's just a nature of, you know, not all 100 seats are up. And so Democrats are defending a lot more seats, and the seats that they're defending are the ones that are the most competitive. So with narrow margins, the opportunities for Republicans to take the Senate are really good. The opposite is true in the House. You've got a very narrow margin in the House. You've had a lot of retirements on both sides, but the retirements in the Republican side have been in more competitive districts, making it easier for Democrats to potentially take the House. You also have seen some of the changes from the courts on redistricting that have made some of the districts more Democratic. And so, you know, with very narrow margins, every seat matters. You know, so conventional wisdom there would tell you that maybe the House flips, but that it'll stay narrow. And the presidential race, I mean, look, you've got the two least popular people running for president in the history of running for president. They're also the two oldest candidates for president, breaking the record that they set 4 years ago. You know, that it's remarkable. You've got one candidate facing, I forget, 98 indictments. The other candidate, you know, is the president is obviously the oldest president ever to run for re-election. You know, he's literally too old to be a baby boomer, which it is an unusual election. And who knows what's going to happen there. And my expectation is that there's about six states that are going to decide this election by probably less than a combined 100,000 votes. And we probably won't know when we go to bed who the next president is. Yeah. And, you know, that's going to be, you know, a very close election. And it's going to be a very contentious after election time period as we get through counting the votes and whoever is sworn in on January 20th is going to have a narrowly divided Congress, a narrowly divided country, and it's going to be a lame duck because they'll be in there. They won't be available to run for another term. So it's going to be, we're in for quite a ride. I would tell you that April 30th in 2020, we had shut down the country for 6 weeks. And if you'd have told me what that election was going to turn out, a few months later, I wouldn't have believed you. So, there is a long time between now and then, and a lot of things that can change this election. But the way it looks at the moment structurally, that, it's a coin toss.
It's probably somewhat safe to assume, regardless of how that coin toss turns out, probably the government isn't going to be overly functional with it so split kind of right down the middle.
Yeah, we've had several elections in a row where we've had a photo finish. And what happens when you do that is the side that didn't win is so close to being in charge that there's very little incentive to work with the other party. And so they instead want to obstruct and keep the other party from gaining any wins and try to take the House or the Senate or the presidency in the next election. I don't foresee that changing in the near future. It will take another election like Obama's election in 2008 to really see a change in that dynamic in Washington, where it looks like the party that is out of power isn't only 18 months away from being back in power. Because when they're that close to being back in power, it takes away any incentive that exists to work across party lines to try to solve problems. And that's an unfortunate part of the way the country is currently divided. But structurally, I don't see that changing in the near future.
Well, we appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Good to talk to you guys.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the program hosts or their employer.